Hey guys, I hope you're doing well. First off, I just want to thank all of you for listening. The numbers are really high right now, and that creates an opportunity for you guys to become more involved with the show, all right, financially speaking. That's right, I am asking you for money. And I'm asking you for money because there's more people listening than ever. And if you guys all just went to BrettWilliamsMusic.com, that's Brett with one T, BrettWilliamsMusic.com, and you click on the podcast link or the talk link or really any link other than the homepage, there will be a thing on the right-hand side, a banner, and you can donate to the show there. And this is why I want you to donate. Like I said, we have more listeners than ever, and if you all donated just a little bit of money, I could actually make a living at this. That's where we're at right now. It's not, maybe not a whole living, but it would subsidize a lot of my day. I would no longer necessarily need to worry about, whether or not I'm going to put cheese on my burrito. I would just, and believe it or not, that is a thing in New York. Some burritos don't have cheese, sir. It's just the way it goes sometimes. And, or I would like to go up to a bartender and be able to not have to ask initially if there are any specials. That would be really cool. It's an expensive city, and this takes up a lot of time. It costs me money to even post it online, a little less all the time that it takes. It takes several hours of several days a week to get this stuff going, whether I'm talking to the publicist, whether I'm talking to, trying to arrange something with a guest, oftentimes at times of the day that aren't necessarily, financially beneficial for me. I might have to move some students back, stuff like that. I have to edit. I don't really necessarily enjoy editing the show. I don't enjoy trying to fish for sponsors. I don't enjoy looking around for guests. I don't enjoy talking to publicists. I don't enjoy posting the show. I certainly didn't enjoy a little four-hour thing that I did the other day trying to figure out how to shrink the amount of megabytes there are in the file so that you guys wouldn't have to, take 2 minutes to download the show. I don't know why that started happening, but that was, a huge thing for me to, run up and down my hallway yelling and swearing about. Anyway, so the fact of the matter is we're 60 some odd episodes in, right? Into something that has created, obviously, a little community of classical guitar enthusiasts and players and teachers. And I really want you guys to be part of this. And I think that you can, simply by donating. You're going to be really helping to keep this thing going. I think it's a really special program. I think it's really neat that we, that it's more or less unedited and that we talk about things in an honest way. And the way it works is that in order to make a living at podcasting, you basically have to have 10,000 listeners a day in order to get a corporate sponsorship. So if you're going to get Squarespace or something like that, you have to have 10,000 listeners a day. Now, look, that's never going to happen in our industry. Our industry really, really depends on good-hearted people to pull the weight a little bit at a time. And I know a lot of you out there aren't made of money. That's why the people that do sponsor the podcast, I give them very reasonable rates because I'm not going to sit there and they don't have money either. And there's nothing that really offends me more than I kind of hate having to do this because there's nothing that pisses me off more than someone in this industry trying to make a lot of money off of someone else in this industry. Teachers that are charging, $300 a lesson and that kind of nonsense. But I'm not asking for $300. I'm not. And this is a very, large program as far as content is concerned. The shows are usually over an hour and a half, or over an hour, let's say. And there's 65 of them now? I mean, if that was in book form, it'd be like an Encyclopedia Britannica of classical guitar with a couple of swear words peppered in. I just hope you guys will take the time to really, help me do this, because I want to keep doing this, but I can't keep doing this. I'm pushing 40, all right? And I can't do arts and crafts for the rest of my life. I have to do something that will make money. And just because this is a small institution run by just me doesn't mean that it doesn't deserve the same help that a classical guitar society deserves, right? Or whatever. I'm really going to depend on you guys for this. This is going to be something we do once a year, maybe twice a year. I don't know. But I'm really going to experiment with this, and I'm going to see, you know, how much support this drums up. So again, thank you guys for listening. First of all, thank you for listening. Do not feel like you can't listen unless you know, donate. But just keep in the back of your mind that eventually you're going to donate something. Just a little bit from every one of you would change my life. There's that many listeners and there's that many people listening a day. So let's do this together. All right, let's keep this community going. You can go to brettwilliamsmusic.com. That's B-R-E-T, one T in Brett, williamsmusic.com. Hit the podcast link or the talk link. And on the right-hand side, there is something that you can donate safely through PayPal, you know, and become part of the action. All right? Become part of it. BrettWilliamsMusic.com podcast. Donate. Thanks so much, and on with the show. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider with your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, we got Pablo Sainz Villegas. Right here in Brooklyn, the first interview in the new apartment. Pablo Sainz Villegas. It was great setting it up. I had enough space to set it up without moving 9 pieces of furniture around and, spraining my ankle. The foot's better if you care, so I was able to do it pain-free. And me and Pablo sat down. That guy is great. We sat there. We talked about his phrasing to begin with. And then we talked about the business, all right, the old biz here. And how difficult it is for me and how difficult it is for him. It put everything into perspective. It was a wonderful conversation with a great guy. All right? And I love it because I love that concert of his. That show was awesome. I saw it a couple of months back. I talked to you guys about it because I usually talk shit on shows. I don't talk shit on people. I don't name names. But I usually say negative things about concerts without naming names that I've seen. In a way of analyzing what's wrong with our little industry here. I mean, who cares? The industry's so small. It's ridiculous. There is no business. You know, I don't know. I think we should all jump ship and just do this as a hobby. That's what I think. I think it's so screwy. Even the show, I mean, it's just silly. You can get hundreds and hundreds of listeners a day and it doesn't matter. It's still not enough. And it's like, how many listeners are you possibly going to get with a classical guitar show? How many musicians are you going to get to go to your concert where it's actually going to make a dent? Anyway, the show is sponsored by ClassicalGuitarCorner.com. You can go there and Simon Powis will teach you how to play guitar better. If you want to get better in October, go to Guitoberfest.com. It's a combination of guitar and October in one word, Guitoberfest.com. You can go there and Ben Verdery, Gohar Vardanyan, Simon Powis himself, and more people. You select your teacher, you select your piece, and they go boom into it. And they teach you how to play better. Highly intensive courses for the intermediate to advanced guitarists this October, Guitoberfest.com, part of the Classical Guitar Corner Network. Be sure to check out Classical Guitar Corner podcast, where Simon shares some tips and tricks with you. Sorry, I hit the microphone there. Sorry to screw up the read, Simon. ClassicalGuitarCorner.com, proud sponsor of Classical Guitar Insider with Brett Williams. And that was a great interview. What else? I don't know what else to talk about today. I really don't have anything to talk about. Usually I have 1,000 things to talk about. I don't want to sit here and talk about Brooklyn versus Manhattan again, because I did that on the last show. But that's still what's going on. Hey, it's August. There's nothing going on. All right, I didn't take a vacation this year. Instead of taking a vacation and sinking $1,000 into that, I went ahead and I moved to where I wanted to live. At least I think it's where I want to live. People still look at me like I'm, you know, walking in late to class when I'm walking down the street here. Or they don't look at me at all. The girls don't look at all. You're not allowed to look at a pretty girl in this neighborhood. You don't do it. It's like physically attacking them. That's what it feels like. So I don't look, because it's like they look like very upset if you look in their direction. So I stopped doing that. That's a new thing. I never used to like sit there and stare at people, but if I saw someone pretty looking down the street, I'd be like, "Well, that's pretty." Like I wouldn't raise my eyebrows and start, you know, making faces at them or whistle at them or anything. I would just maybe like, for maybe a 1 second, just like give them a little once over. Oh, what did I do here? Oh, what is going on? Oh, I can hear the. Oh, okay. Sorry about this, guys. Let me mute this. I didn't mute the interview. And the interview was starting to come through. Oh my God, was I recording on top of the interview? Tell me I wasn't. I wasn't. Okay, good. So anyway, sorry. So you're not allowed to look at girls. And then I'm older than everybody, which is fine. I think I'm like the top of the chain of age here. I think 38 is pretty much the oldest you can be and not get arrested. I think that if you're 40, you're probably asked very politely by the hipsters to leave the neighborhood. So there is that sort of shame for having any sort of I should post a picture. You know, I got this picture of me from the beach that makes me look so fat. I love it, and I don't know whether to post it and have everybody think I'm a fat guy. Or, it's so funny, I don't know what to do. It's me holding an umbrella, and the way that the light hits my belly, it just makes it look like I have this giant belly. And I love the picture. I like the colors in it and everything. I think it's a pretty picture. It also makes it look like I have a small head and a big body, which is the opposite, if you know me, of what's going on. There was a time when I had a small head and a bigger body. I was much younger. And then I just kept on pushing it up until it went into my head. Anyway, so what happened is, you know, I've got that. There is the pretense. There is the whole, the richest white people in the world pretending that they are the poorest people in the world. They just crawled out from under a tunnel, under the BQE. I don't know why I'm doing chores while I'm talking to you guys during an intro. Just cleaning things. I'm obsessed with keeping the apartment clean. You know, it's new. Everything's new. I got my IKEA furniture. It's getting scuffed up, though. I gotta put a finish on it, like a varnish. Right? I got to do something to it. This is what happened to my guitar. I had a French polish on my guitar, and now it looks like, I've been wiping my ass with it for 10 years. So I got to do something, because I've got the cheap IKEA furniture. You know, the stuff that's all just pine, unfinished. And it's very pretty now, but it's already getting scuffed up because Wendy's got garbage that she puts out every day. She's got rings and stuff, and now they're scraping away at my beautiful little desk here. Yep, you can see. This is where the earrings are, and that's where the scuffs are. I can't say anything to her, though, because then I'd be telling her what to do, and God forbid that happens. All right. The show is also sponsored by SavageClassical.com. You can go to SavageClassical.com. That's SAVAGE, Classical.com. And Richard Sage, owner-proprietor, right there in Bayshore, New York. Go take a beach day. All right. While I'm polishing this wood, you can go take a beach day, and you can go you can go polish your wood on the beach and get the guitar of your dreams at SavageClassical.com. All right, they got the best guitars in the world, like the houses. If you want to Hermann Hauser, you can go there. And you can also get some of the cheapest guitars in the world. That's not true. Not the cheapest. Cordobas, I love them. I tell my students to get them. What do you guys think about those Cordobas? I think they're revolutionary. I think that before them, we were stuck with Yamahas and Takamines. And those Cordobas, even though sometimes the bridges do fall off, but they replace them. At least that was the case 10 years ago. I don't think that's the case anymore. Hopefully they're using a different glue. But the Cordobas are the best sounding beginner guitars I've ever heard. And they are available at SavageClassical.com. Go to Bayshore, New York. Eat some beach pizza and get a guitar. That's what I say. That's my read. Do the reads last too long on this? I don't think so. I think I say the same things every week, but that's what I'm supposed to do. Anyway, like I said, I got nothing to talk about. What was I going to talk about? Well, you know, like I said, it's back to school. How about that? Let's talk about that, right? How are you parents doing? You guys hanging in there? I'm not a parent. I don't have a child, but if I did, this would be kind of a fun time. I like back to school. The kids are happy. They're excited. They got butterflies in their stomach. There's a closeness at this point, I would imagine, between the parents and the children. You guys get to buy them a bunch of stuff. They get their new shoes. All right, what'd you go with? Did you break the bank on their tennis shoes? That's the question. Did you give them the shoes they want? Did you give them the Nikes? You're a guitar teacher and you're giving your kid Nikes. What's the matter with you? Nothing's the matter with you. Give them the Nikes. Don't be a cheap asshole. All right? Don't be that way. There's no reason to be that way. I didn't like it when my dad was that way. My dad was kind of poor, but you know what? He found ways to pay for the things he wanted. He found ways to buy the boat. But I had to wear purple, Reebok pumps to school so that Jamie Magdaleno could tease me. All right? And sit there and call my shoes girl shoes. I said, they're not girl shoes. They were Reebok pumps, but they were the only ones I could get because they were on sale because they were purple. All right, so Jamie Magdaleno, who still is very pretty, and actually reached out to me the other day. She's like married to a baseball player. He played for the Arizona whatchamacallits, Diamondbacks. And she just wanted to say hi. And I was like, oh, that looks nice. You got a baseball player husband. That's good. Anyway, she was very nice for the rest of my life. But she was very mean about my purple Reebok pumps that I got for back to school. Back to school 90. Back to school, what would that be? 92, 91? That's about right. Right? Right there. That's kind of where we're at stylistically here in Brooklyn. People dress like it's 1991. That's what I need to do. I need to go home and pull out all those dusty Z Cavaricci and Benetton shirts and dress like I'm in a house party. Then I'll fit in. All right? I just have to uglify myself. It's okay. It really doesn't matter what you wear as long as it's ugly. That's the key. You got to make it ugly. You got to wear ugly shit or super expensive shit. You're not allowed to wear normal shit that's not ugly. I'm sorry for using the S-H-I-T word so much, kids, today. It is back to school, after all. Should be thinking of the kids. Are you guys ready to go back to school and teach for another year and make another $20,000? You guys ready for that? Let's go. I don't know. I guess I'm doing it again. Didn't I say I was going to quit? I think at the end of last year, one of the podcasts, I was like, you know what? This is it. I'm done teaching. Well, folks, here I am again, ready to go. And I am ready to go. That's the problem, is once the break's over, you're ready to teach again. It doesn't seem like it's going to be that hard. And then come January, you want to apply as an intern to JP Morgan because you are so fed up with the whole racket. But right now I feel fine and I miss the kids and I want to be around them and I'm really excited to go back and teach. And maybe this year will be different. So that's where we're at right now with the back to school. But right now it's August. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to enjoy the break that I have. Enjoy it. I'm back to concertizing in September. There's a concert on the 20-something. I don't know. It'll be on the website. I'll talk about it more. Then there's a concert in December in New York City. And then it really starts to pick up in 2016 for the old quartet there. So, I'm having to start to practice again. And I've been working on my old dystonia in my right hand and just chilling out, you know, just trying to enjoy the neighborhood. And actually, you know, I'm talking a lot of crap, but it's pretty fun. And I had pizza last night for the first time. We ordered pizza. Williamsburg Pizza. That stuff is unreal. Oh my God, it was so good. And that's the thing. The Upper East Side sort of just kind of became strip mallish. So it was like, you get what you get, you know? There was more pizza up there, though. I'll give them that. The show's also sponsored by audibletrial.com/insider. You don't go to audible.com. Okay, audible.com is a porn site. I'm just joking. I don't know that. But I know that I don't get any money if you go to audible.com. I do get money if you go to audibletrial.com/insider. All right? You got to go to that. audibletrial.com/insider. You get to do a trial, 30-day free trial, and a free audiobook download of your choice. Why don't you download What Am I Reading Right Now? Last time we talked, I was reading To Kill a Mockingbird. Finished that one up. Joe Abercrombie, Half a War, the third book in the Half a King series. I'm pretty sure it's on there. I know the first one's on there, which is Half a King. Now, I don't like these ones as much as I liked his other stuff. I like the First Law series. Joe Abercrombie's First Law series. It's unreal. It's like a Kurosawa movie and George R. R. Martin put together. It's amazing fantasy. Very adult, very, very clear. The Half a King series is great if you're a kid. I went into it not really understanding that it was a kid's sort of. It was Joe Abercrombie trying to write kid's stuff after writing raunchy adult, you know, very sexual fantasy fiction. And the Half a King series, as opposed to the First Law series, is kind of more or less for kids. It's a little bit played down. There is death and there is blood, but there is there's not really swearing so much or any of the sex or any of the serious, you know, decapitation stuff and stuff like that. Anyway, what a read, huh? That's audibletrial.com/insider. And, you know, get yourself some Joe Abercrombie. All right, you got to get that escapist literature in you, folks. That's what I need. I need to escape the fact that I'm going back to school to teach for another year. Jesus. Beginners again. You know? Where did I go wrong? That's the thing. I just don't want to teach beginner guitar again. Is that right? Once you've been teaching for 15 years, don't you have a right to teach better? I mean, the kids are great, but it's like, dude, just, all right, make a fist with your right hand. Sit still. Okay, now make the fist with your right hand. Now take your finger, your pointer finger, we're going to call that your eye finger, and put it on the first string. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Enough complaining. Everything's fine. It's going to be great. It's nice. It's August. Everybody relax. Force yourselves to take a break and enjoy your time off because it's going to be gone and then you're going to be really upset. So if you think you're upset now, it's only going to get worse. Just relax. All right. Try to sit in your apartment. Try to not go on a huge vacation that costs a lot of money. Try to not be sad. Because you're sitting on your apartment and you can't afford a vacation. Try to not be sad because you're going to do the same job that you never really signed up for again in a couple of weeks. Take deep breaths, maybe do some meditation, I don't know. Do something that makes you happy, have a beer. Hang out with friends. All right, that's important. Do the friend thing. All right, talk to your friends. Reach out to them. You got some time on your hands? Talk to your friends. Don't be a dick. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Speaking of somebody who's not a dick, here's Pablo Sainz Villegas.
Yeah, so Americana is my latest recording, yeah. And it's going to be released on September 11th.
Americana.
And then it will be presented, the launch of the CD will be at Joe's Pub. Here in New York City.
Wait, now who is that through Ben? Is that through Ben Battery?
No, it wasn't. It was through my management, but still, you know, it's going to be presented there September 29th at 7:30.
Good choice. I like that you're getting out of the concert hall.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because Joe's Pub is a great venue.
I think it's a fantastic venue.
Small, intimate.
And in the end, music is for the people. And
it
that's a strong mission for me, you know.
Music belongs. It's not just for guitar societies.
Exactly. Music belongs to people, and it's for them that we play the guitar. So, and that we do music. So, you know, Joe's Pub has like all these different audiences that are welcome to attend on September 29th.
Yeah, I went there and I saw a couple of guitar shows. They used to have a little festival there years ago, mm-hmm. a while ago, you know, where they would mix it up. It would be like Andy Summers and Ben Verdery or something like nice. That when I first came here. But I guess you, now, when did you come here? When did you come to New York?
Well, I came after having studied 5 years in Germany. So, and then I wanted to come to New York. I wanted to study with David Starobin. I was very interested in contemporary music at that time. So that was brought me here. And I've always been attracted by this metropolis with, you know, so much multiculturality and so many people from all around the world. And you know, it's through the difference that you have the chance to learn from each other. So New York always was like a dream for me. And so in 2001, I arrived here. And yeah, and I made New York
now,
my home.
Now, what were you doing? You were doing a master's there or what?
Yeah. At Manhattan School of Music with Dave Starobin, I did a bunch of different programs. I did a master, professional studies, and artist diploma was my last degree with him.
Yeah. I can't believe this is the first time we're meeting because we're the same age, I think. Are you 38?
I'm 38. Yeah, that's 77.
Right, me too.
Wow.
So we were both here doing masters at the same time.
Amazing. And were you at Manhattan? No, at Manus.
Manus.
Yeah.
I was at
but
Manus.
But still, Upper West Side,
what
guitarist.
The fuck? Why didn't we ever meet each other?
Well, it was meant to be today.
I know.
On this radio show.
That's good. Well, I mean, it's really unbelievable that you, you know, what's going on with you. First of all, you know, just looking at this CD, one of the things that struck me about your playing, I know I'm kind of going into this early, but I want to remember to mention it, is the way that you perform the preludes. Which are often performed in student recitals, but aren't often performed as concert pieces. And you killed it. You absolutely destroyed it. I had never seen you play before. I've seen, you know, maybe some videos and stuff like that, which I never really take to heart. But when I saw you play, I can easily say it was the best concert I've seen in 10 years. It was unreal. And one of the things that made it so great was the way that you played the preludes. Because when, you know, when I opened up the thing, I was sitting next to some other guitarists, we opened up the program and we were like, preludes, okay. And I think you opened with them.
Yeah.
And just, you breathed an entirely new life into those preludes. The way that you phrased, the fact you take so much time, you don't rush your phrasing. The way you play is not, it's not just unique, it's also just, it's something that's missing a lot of the time in other people's playing. Did you ever think about that when you were approaching playing the preludes? The fact that most people would view it as maybe you doing like a, you know, like a student recital, so to speak.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Brett.
Yeah, no problem.
For me, that's how I approach music. So for me, everything is on the score, but then, you know, we need to infuse life into it, and we need to make it alive. So, you know, it's a whole process, no? It's about being very respectful with what's written in the score. But then, you know, the more subtle you are with your decision-making, the more possibilities you have as a musician.
Subtlety, yeah.
Exactly, to develop your own artistry. So, what I, you know, I grew up listening to the preludes by Angel Romero. My dad has this LP collection of different CDs.
Yeah.
And that was the music I listened the most when I was a kid.
Right.
But when I went back to the preludes and I wanted to you know, create my own stamp about the interpretation.
And you probably taught them. I mean, I don't know how much teaching you've done, but I'm assuming you did it in the past, or?
Yeah, not much. I don't teach much, but it's something very natural to me. So when I see a student, I see what's needed to be corrected or how I can improve wherever he is, because I mean, it doesn't matter the level you are at. A good teacher can always help you to bring you to the next level.
Yeah.
So you know, that's easy for me. So with the preludes, I wanted to approach them, to get close to them in a very fresh, neutral way, and just, you know, explore what's between the notes, because it's those subtleties in the end is, you know, magic in music is between notes, and it's so subtle what you can do there, but still, you know, it's like in a sculpture. When you start with a hammer and, you know, peeling off all the big rocks, but then, you know, you ended up with a file and doing the subtleties in the face, or, you know, the eyes or the lips. So it's the same way. So it's first is, okay, what's going on? And then let's understand what Villalobos wanted to express.
Yeah.
And once you understand that, is how I want to bring sense to what's written.
Right.
And put my own personality in it. So, you know, and that's how I approach any music, actually. And for me, it's a fresh view, and let's have fun with it.
Yeah, you can tell that that's what you're doing. I've always, you know, when I knew less about music, when I was, you know, a kid, I used to think of interpretation in terms of long form and short form. So there was just, I used to talk about it as in, there was a relationship between two notes, and then there was a relationship between 10 notes. And I've always sort of been attracted to the interpretations that seem to really pay attention to the relationship between two notes.
Definitely.
And I mean, we learn how to phrase, and we learn, and that's something that we learn in the conservatories. But the ability to know, you know, exactly where to place the next note, I mean, that's really what makes a great player, a player that I want to listen to. And so, I mean, you're saying that that's something that you've always focused on, and that's, I think that that's sort of the quantified idea of what you're saying when you're saying subtlety. You're saying getting into the tiny little nuts and bolts.
Details, exactly.
The details.
Exactly.
The details.
That's what makes the difference in art in general. Right. And for me, you know, it's what you said about two notes, but also the big structure. So it's everything. It's both things. It's you know, looking at the whole architectural cathedral of some pieces, or, you know, any piece. You know, either if it's a small architecture or a big architecture, looking at the big scope of it, and then, you know, trying to go closer and closer, and
it is a lot to be responsible for.
Yeah, and it's great, and it's fantastic.
Because you're not—it's like you're hammering in every little nut and bolt, and you're also, you know, I mean, I guess the composer gives you the blueprint, but then you're everything from the nuts and bolts to pouring the cement. Everything is your responsibility.
Exactly, and that's the exciting thing: is to be part of the creative and artistic process that started the composer.
Right.
And then, you know, you are the one that brings alive that music, and then the audience is the one who completes the circle. So it's in the end these three emotional processes, no? The composer, me being part of the process and the music of the composer, and then the audience, you know, it's for them that we play music.
Right. What is your relationship? You brought this up. You actually brought this up maybe when you came in. I don't know if we recorded it or not, but you talked about the audience for the second or third time. Do you have some sort of perspective when it comes to the audience? It seems like you have a special relationship with them.
For me, audience.
I guess this is coming from when we were talking about you premiering your new CD. It's going to come out in September, Americano at Joe's Pub. What's the date on that, actually?
September 29th.
Okay, because this will go out before then, so that's good.
Great.
September 29th.
At 7:30 p.m.
At Joe's Pub. Which
yes.
And we were talking about, you know, getting the music out of the, what are viewed by many as the uncomfortable concert halls of the world, right? Long, you're there for a long time, it's kind of uncomfortable. Most of the time, the performers don't speak. You speak a lot.
Yeah.
And moving it into something more for the people. Joe's Pub. Joe's Pub is short for Joe's Public.
Yeah. Not right? For pub. Exactly.
Well, I guess, yeah, not for like public house, but it's short. I think it's short for, it's part of the public theater.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's
the
part
thing
of
is,
the public
yeah,
theater
so
of New York.
There's a certain sort of socialism in what we're doing right
yes.
now.
Yes. and I love that because,
yeah,
you know, it's, I mean, our responsibility as musicians is, or my responsibility as a musician is to inspire people.
Yeah.
Anyone. It doesn't matter if they are musicians or not. It doesn't matter whether, you know, they are rich or poor. It doesn't matter whether, you know, they are from China from Spain or mm-hmm. from Honolulu. It doesn't matter. Music, that's the strength and the great value of music. Music is the language of the emotions, and that's where we all connect.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
And that's, you know, my goal as a musician in the end is to connect to the audience. That's why I speak to them, because word is the most basic way of communication. Mm-hmm. So just addressing them and greeting them, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're about to start a journey.
Right.
So this is what I'm going to play. And this piece means this or that. Or you know, I feel connected in this piece in this way. Or try to listen to this little surprise that he's going to, mm-hmm. to put by the end of the piece. I mean, there are so many ways to connect and to make to create the right environment. Mm-hmm. So the emotional connection is going to be deeper and more natural, no? And for me, in that respect, audience is the most valuable thing of the whole process, because without them, nothing would exist.
Yeah.
The composer wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
The performance wouldn't exist. So, you know, we do what we do, or I do what I do for the audience. And yeah. I know my audience, and I want to give them an experience. I want to recreate an experience. It's not just about music or
you
about
notes. You want to entertain.
Exactly, because yeah. we're on a stage. We're in the show business, too.
Yes,
so,
sir.
And
I've said that 1,000 times on the show.
Exactly.
And I think most people forget that in
exactly.
our genre.
And many people in the classical music world, they forget that.
They don't only forget it. They hold the audience oftentimes in contempt.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They're the enemy.
Exactly.
They're the enemy.
And it's on the contrary. They are our friends. They are our friends.
It's easy to be combative because you feel like, at least, you know, when you're performing, there are times, especially when you're first getting started, where you're nervous.
Yeah.
And you want to hold somebody accountable for that nervousness.
Exactly.
And
but
they're right there.
Exactly. You need someone to blame, right?
Yeah, it's them. But they don't get it.
Exactly. But this is...
Especially you were talking about going into new music.
Exactly. And it's on the contrary. You know, mm-hmm. it's on the contrary. They are our friends. Yeah. They are the excuse for us to practice many hours for many years.
Right.
They are, I mean, everything what I do is for them. And they are our friends. So for me, it's so important to make them feel that they are my friend too.
Right.
And I'm nervous, yes.
But that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Are you a nervous guy when
you're
performing?
I couldn't
Some
say.
Some people say they never get nervous. I get nervous, and then I have to perform enough to not get nervous.
I get nervous, mm-hmm. but most people, I mean... You know, if you speak to Plácido Domingo, he would say, every time I go on a stage, you know, after 50 years of career, mm-hmm. I get nervous. So that's good. I mean, that's we're humans.
Okay.
We feel.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we are going to be in front of 3,000 people, it's perfectly normal to feel nervous.
Right.
So, you know, I think I get nervous, of course, but right. that's good. But the good thing is that you need to take that adrenaline to play better. To go to a deeper concentration, to go to an emotional place where, you know, I can only get if I'm nervous.
100, that's an, God, you know what, that is 100% true. You have that kind of meditative trance, especially when you're performing music that you've memorized.
Yes.
The only way to get there when you're nervous is to go into that trance.
Exactly.
You can't. You know, you can't be worrying about certain things, so you really need to let go and
exactly.
have an out-of-body experience.
Exactly.
If you're going to get through that hour.
Exactly.
There's no other way about it.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, I enjoy very much, or I prefer to play by heart without the scores, because for me, when I'm playing with a score, my perception somehow is out. I'm looking at the score, and it's a bidimensional thing, you know, flat. But you know, if I'm playing by heart, the music is inside myself and just pours out. It blossoms out.
Unbelievable.
And
true.
Then you know, then it's not a flat two-dimensional reality, but it's a three-dimensional reality that exists in the air and is, you know, is waves that we don't see but we feel.
Right.
So that belongs to magic, to the magic things that happen in life.
That's
that's very powerful.
Very, very, very. I always memorized everything. I was in a duo, and I was I played as a solo. And in both situations, I memorized everything. I never played with anything. And then now I've got this ensemble that I was telling you about, and I didn't. I played one concert with them, and I didn't. And, yeah, it didn't feel the same.
Hmm.
I felt more like a technician.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I mean, I was being expressive, but I was not being expressive like I am when I have something memorized.
Exactly.
So I feel like I got to be... Have you seen Batman? You seen Batman, The Dark Knight Returns?
No, I haven't,
I'm not
going to
give it away or anything, but there's a situation that he gets in where they give him a rope, a harness, so that if he, you know, falls, he's okay. And he couldn't have made the jump that he needed to make unless he didn't have the rope.
Uh-huh.
So now I'm thinking maybe I should just take the music away and just not have it anywhere.
Exactly.
And if I screw up and if everything gets screwed up and we all lose our place and the whole thing falls to shit, maybe it's worth it because I don't want to have that rope, you know?
Well, and let me tell you something that connects with that.
Okay. You're going to have to connect a lot because I'm not always good at that.
If that's the way you feel, you should go for it. Mm-hmm. Because if you are the kind of person that really, when you are playing by heart, you connect in a different way to music, then go for it. Then the next thing is going to be, okay, how am I going to memorize that music so it feels so secure and so fixed within myself that, you know, I know it's just going to be a ride through it.
Right.
It's just going to be a journey. It's going to be natural to come alive.
Yeah.
So then that's, you know, for me, memorizing is very important, and it requires its own methodology. So
no, let's talk about that. I'm sure people would be.
Yeah. So for me, it's a visualization. It's based on visualization. So, you know,
me too. Yeah.
I don't use the guitar. I'm in a dark room and with a score on the table, and I close my eyes and I start visualizing what we said before, the whole architecture. And I see it as if it were a painting.
Okay, so you can visualize the whole piece.
Exactly. So music requires time to be performed and to be enjoyed. But when I'm doing memorization, I convert that dimension of time into space. So it becomes a painting. It's like a painting that you see, and in a split of a second, you can describe that there's a house, a car, some clouds, and a mountain. And in 1 second, you saw all that.
But you have to
that.
Force yourself
definitely
to take a step back and not do a note-to-note like A, B,
also,
A, B, C. Right?
Also.
You have to do that also.
Also. So I do the whole thing. I do.
But I've never heard about that. I've never heard about being able to step back and picture from a distance the different sections of a piece.
And I recommend it for memorization because it gives you such a security that you know the piece.
Right.
So this is the process. You visualize the whole thing with the structures, right? If it's a sonata, you see the first theme, the second theme, perhaps a transition, the development, the reposition with the different keys. And then you start note by note.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm memorizing note by note, going through the notes of the, I'm visualizing my left hand and my right hand, how they are playing those notes in the fingerboard.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, during that process, there are going to be some gaps where you don't remember the note.
Mm-hmm.
So I turn on the lights. Oh, it's a G. Okay, of course, yeah. So, and I rewind.
You actually have the lights
bit.
Off?
Yeah. Because it's easier for me to concentrate
on
the notes.
So this is a big time.
Yeah.
This is a big time. This isn't just something that you might do once a week. This is something that you're doing every day.
And not every day, but...
When you're preparing for performance.
Exactly.
And it's something that you do... It's methodical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
part of your practice.
Exactly.
Right.
So before going on a stage, I do this process.
Right.
And then when you are done, perhaps you discover that there were 3-4... spots where you didn't know the notes,
right?
Your brain didn't know the notes, and those are the dangerous places where when you are under pressure on stage, your brain doesn't know the notes, and you are under pressure.
100%. And then what do? You start freaking out.
Exactly.
That's what I always tell the kids. I say, because they don't want to visualize at all. The children do not want to visualize. Anybody out there doesn't want to visualize, you're wrong. And the big thing is that it depends on how nervous you get. I am just naturally, in all situations, not just guitar, sort of a nervous guy. I mean, I kind of,
I'm
always kind of like a little worried that I'm going to miss the train or that something bad's going to, I'm just, you know, that way. And if you're that kind of a person and you get on stage, the easiest way to calm those nerves is to be able to answer the own question, is to be able to answer those questions when they come up, because they do come up.
Exactly.
You're sitting there and you have to be able to say, no, it's okay. I know the next section. It's a C chord. I know what's going to happen next because I know that.
Exactly.
And then if you can answer those questions
exactly.
enough, your body
that's
will relax.
The secret. Because most of the time, if you rely on your muscles,
right.
I mean, you can learn the chaconne by heart and with muscle memory and, you know, playing or looking at TV or watching TV right. and playing
no
the whole
deal.
Thing.
Right.
And it's like, what did I do? How did I do? I don't know. But, you know, I play the whole chaconne.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the muscles don't think.
No.
And when they are under pressure, muscles ask the brain, okay, what's the next note? Because they are nervous.
And
they don't know what to mean.
Work.
And if the brain doesn't know the answer, then you are in trouble.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, this process helps you to feel so secure. And if a little mistake or something happens, you know, we are humans and it's very important to accept ourselves as we are.
Yeah.
We are humans and we are not perfect, thank God.
Right.
So, you know, that's part of musicianship. So, you know, when you have a mistake, the brain will give you an answer, what's the next move, and it will, you know, I don't know how, but it will tell you.
I don't expect you to know how.
But it will tell you
yeah.
that you know the next chord, you know how it goes. You know, I mean, so it brings you so much confidence working on memorization, and then the important thing is to interiorize that. You know, we are on a stage to play for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
We are on a stage because we want to be there.
Right.
The audience is there because they want to be there and they want to enjoy your music. So it's not a big deal
yeah.
if we miss a note. It even if you make a big mistake, it does, you know, we need to work in the pursuit of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, we are humans.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we need to do everything in our hand to achieve that perfection.
Right.
But then once we are on a stage, you know, we need to love ourselves. Because the more we love ourselves, the more the audience will love us.
Mm.
And you know, and trying to forgive ourselves for any human mistake that we made.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm telling you this, and it sounds so easy to say,
but it's not easy when you're up there.
Exactly, and
to
for
forgive
me,
yourself.
Exactly, and for me, it's been a process of years. And you know, I'm opening my heart here to say that you know I suffered a lot also because you know
you
I'm
suffered
very,
a lot from performance anxiety.
Yeah, not from that, but
okay.
for not forgiving myself.
Okay,
because I was always able to really play under pressure with no problem.
Okay.
And, you know, even if I was nervous, you know, with all my methodology, you know, I was able to go there and play and move the fingers and being part of the music and getting into this deep concentration. But then, you know, I wasn't very good at forgiving myself if I made a mistake. And that's something that, you know, why hurting yourself?
How would that manifest itself? Would it make you... Would it make the performance more difficult to get through, or in the bigger picture, would it make it where once the performance was done, you were afraid of performing again? What effect did that have on
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I
had a hard time forgiving yourself.
Yeah, I was never afraid of going back to stage,
mm-hmm.
but I was upset with myself that I could have done better.
Yeah,
that's the only thing.
I think that's just the way we're programmed as. Performers and entertainers, though. I mean, as athletes, almost.
Exactly. Like, and
we have a competitive element.
Yeah.
Not against other people.
Yeah.
But just we want to do the best we can do.
Exactly.
You know?
But, you know, that's why we need to forgive ourselves. Because what's the point? I mean, the performance is done.
Yeah.
So, you know, and even if you had a mistake, it's so important to let it go. And you know, even I'll do a mistake because I want to make a mistake. What? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you are on a stage. You're about to start. And if you think, now I'm going to do a mistake because I want to make a mistake. And boom, you do a mistake. What? Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Right. What? It doesn't matter.
And you wanted to do that mistake. So why, if that mistake happened by chance, because, you know, it was something that you couldn't do anything about it. So What? It doesn't happen. It's not a big deal.
That might be a good idea. Just get out there and make a mistake because for fun.
Yeah. What? I mean, I was thinking that. Why not?
And there's a lot of reasons why not, but I think it's okay. Listen, I don't think you need to do it, but I think, you know.
Well, especially to understand and to think.
Put it into perspective.
Put it into perspective. That's the point.
Yeah. To so put it into perspective. Oh, there's that little mistake.
And in the end, you know, we play, what?
Obsessed.
50,000 notas in one performance. If we miss 10, you know, it's not a big deal.
Right. It's not a big deal. It's not a big
deal. Because the most important thing.
Feels big.
Yeah, exactly. Feels big, but this is nothing. And the most important thing is the emotional commitment.
That's 100% true.
And that's the most important thing.
Right.
If you are fully emotional committed to the piece, people will get that.
Right.
And music is, you know, the instrument we have to deliver the emotions.
Right.
And to connect to people. So if you missed a few notes, that won't affect the message.
Yeah.
And for me, and this is a metaphor I like to tell, every note is like a soap bubble that you blow into the audience. Mm-hmm. And with every single note, you deposit one message within the bubble.
Okay.
It's an emotional message wherever you want to put.
Right.
Anything. But just being aware that you have the possibility to put something.
Right.
So if you have the possibility to put something, why leaving it blank?
Right.
So you put something.
And you hope for the best.
Exactly. And then, you know, the audience will get it.
Yeah.
And that bubble, you know, the message will be released.
It's 100%, and it's just the big concerts that everybody, you know, when we left your concert, everybody was very happy. And it's like when you have those kinds of concerts, the big thing is emotional connection, emotional commitment.
Exactly, exactly.
Emotional commitment.
Exactly.
And that's not something that's just not something you see enough of.
Yeah, and that's something that people are not aware of the power of it.
I don't even think we are, because we're sitting there, we're thinking about the power of nailing a scale.
Exactly.
We're like, if I can nail this scale, everybody will like me.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, you know, everybody might, you know, tolerate you, but they're not really going to like you unless you're likable. And people don't like people that don't, you know, I mean, it's much easier to like someone at a party if they're open.
Exactly.
And if they're vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you know, I've never really liked someone who just wants to be cool,
exactly,
you know, and wants to be fast. And I'm not talking about just on guitar.
Anything.
I've never been the kind of guy that's like, I just, you know, that needs. I've never been attracted to that personality. So
it's a human connection.
Most people aren't.
It's a human connection. Yeah. So in the end, as a musician, it's the same thing. Human condition. So you need, I like to go on a stage vulnerable, mm-hmm. as I am. With my shades and my lights, and you know, open my heart to the audience and invite them to be part of the journey, the musical journey, through my truthful and trying to be honest with music and with my own feelings. And that's in the end what it's all about. It's about emotions. So people want to be touched. People wanna, you know.
They do. They want to be touched.
They
wanna
need.
Connect.
They need.
Right.
You know, and that's why I'm so positive about the future of classical music, because the more technology, the more technology is around us, you know, we are more connected, but at the same time, most disconnected with ourselves. So what can music provide is that connection, that emotional connection with parts of your sensitivity that technology cannot.
Right.
And that's through, you know, human emotions.
And the genre that addresses that with the most immediacy is classical music.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's
very
true.
It's totally natural.
I was just talking to a friend the other day who doesn't listen to a lot of classical music, a very good friend of mine. And he was talking about, you know, I don't know, we were going camping, a bunch of us, it's like 2 weeks ago or whatever. And he said, you know, I don't think people don't like classical music. I think people don't like jazz. Some people don't like electronic music. And he goes, but everybody would like it. It's just, you know, because I was telling him about because I played at a bar that's where I premiered the quartet. And you know, I just was saying that it was just, that's just, I feel like that's what's missing, is that we need to, yeah, like, be able to open it up more to people. And like you're saying, you're being optimistic about the future of classical music because of technology. In other words, these people actually can get a hold of it now. It's a lot easier for them just to try it out, you know?
And in general, because it belongs...
It music. Belongs to everybody now.
Exactly. It belongs to everybody, yeah. And it's music.
Right, so that's the problem. That's the problem, is reconciling the fact that... Because on this show, a lot we talk about the issue of being able to make money with recordings, which is damn near impossible now. To be able to make relevant, a living wage... as a recording artist, and the way you have to do it now is by selling concerts, charging more for those concerts. But even then, but we don't talk about the flip side, the positives of things like Spotify, of things like Rhapsody. And the positives is that people, regular people, can now just try to listen to Beethoven. It's not this giant box set that costs $80 that they need to buy.
Exactly.
It's now they can kind of dip around and check out the different quartets, and maybe they just like that sort of, you know...
Even if they like one movement, right. Or one...
But now, yeah.
They got connected to something that before they were not before exposed.
They just weren't... It wasn't around. It wasn't around.
Exactly.
It was like one movement within a soundtrack, and they were like, well, I like that one.
Yeah.
Then I went and listened to another movement of something. I didn't like it, so I stopped.
Yeah.
It's like, because it does. It used to cost money. Now it doesn't cost that much money to be able to experiment as a listener.
What requires to enjoy music is to be sensitive. And if mm-hmm. you enjoy one genre of music, most probably you are going to enjoy classical music.
Yeah.
You might have your favorite composers, your favorite styles, but you know...
Yeah, that's true. If you're a music fan, eventually you can't imagine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in the end, I cannot see... anyone not enjoying, I don't know, this beautiful music by Gabrieli Palestrina,
right.
This vocal polyphony.
Right.
I mean, this is, as Messiaen said in his opera San Francis of Assisi, music is the language of the angels to speak to God. And, you know, this is so beautiful, transcendental. I mean, there is no human condition that couldn't enjoy something that is beautiful, that is beauty. And you know, I created in 2007 a philanthropic project working in Tijuana and San Diego and also in Spain. And I've played for 15,000 kids, underprivileged kids that never had any contact with art whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to see their reaction when I played for them, mm-hmm. when I told them stories about the pieces, when I make them feel related to me and to that music I was playing. You know,
it is different.
It's
different.
It exceeded, the response exceeded my best expectations.
Right.
It's really amazing. So the question is how to invite people to participate of that experience, mm-hmm. to go where they are.
To go where they are.
And offer them the hand.
Right.
And let's go together for a journey. And that's what I try to do when I'm playing for my audience is, you know, hello, how are you?
Right. Yeah.
I go where you are. It doesn't matter if I'm playing in Tijuana for underprivileged kids or I'm playing, you know, at Carnegie Hall. It doesn't matter. We are humans.
Mm-hmm.
And human emotions, you know, don't care about the clothes you put on. So
yeah.
I go there, and wherever they are, I extend my hand and invite them to participate of the experience. It's all about the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were saying, I mean, you know, let's go into your musical experience. You're from Spain, and you came here to study with David Starobin. So I think what we'll do is we'll go back to the David Starobin thing. Because it does strike me that this CD, Louis Bonfa, you know, Antonio Lauro, John Williams, Villa-Lobos, there's nothing David Starobin about this at all. You're doing transcriptions and you're doing, you know, I mean, there is, I don't know a lot of Gutierrez.
Okay. There is the John Williams, which, you know, that the,
that's John Williams, the film composer.
The film composer, right. You know, and I had the privilege to meet him, and he composed this very good piece that could be closer to David Starovin's.
David Starovin would maybe do that, right?
Yeah.
But as far as your decision to study with him, so there was a time in 2001 where you thought that perhaps you wouldn't be going down this path that you're on now, which is inclusive, tonal, you know, and you're on the Harmonia Mundi label. You're not on whatchamacallit, Bridge. So there's something about you that is not the same kid that went and tried to get into new music. What was your initial attraction to you know, let's say harmonically challenging music?
Well, it's a process.
Yeah.
And,
you got into it for a while, then you...
Exactly, and it's a process, and I'm not saying now that I don't like contemporary music. Mm-hmm. I love it, and, you know, I... during that time with David Starovin, we were working on the Sequenza number 11 by Luciano Berio, which, you know,
it took me
6 years to learn that piece. And then, you know, through this methodology, I was able to memorize it, the whole thing.
Okay.
And it's crazy. I mean, it's 16 right. minutes of very intense music.
Right.
Anyway, I was really into contemporary music at that time. I had been playing also in a contemporary music ensemble in Spain, and we worked with Helmut Lachenmann, with George Cram, with all these amazing, great composers, living composers, and they would go there and they would, you know, they would lead the rehearsals. It was very inspiring, and I feel very connected to contemporary music as much as playing, you know, folk music from South America, because in the end, it's music and how you approach it. So, one of the great things about being a musician is you can play anything, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if I wanted, you know, I could go with a rock band and play some chords and, you know, and have fun with them playing chords.
Yeah.
I choose to play the music I'm playing because I like it, or because, you know, I'm building a career, and you set up what's the artistic goals you want to achieve, and what's how you are building the strategy of your career and your artistic statement.
Okay.
Saying that, we have an instrument, the guitar, which is the best, in my opinion, the best instrument in the world.
Yeah.
Why do I say that?
Well,
because
why?
It's my instrument first, sure. And if I don't love it, who else will love it?
Sure.
But then, you know, it's so...
I do love it the best. I mean, I think we all...
It's so versatile.
Yeah.
The guitar is so versatile. And, you know, and I admire piano, violin. I mean, they have such a great repertoire. They have Beethoven, they have Mozart, they have Schubert, they have everybody. I wished we had that repertoire. But we have different repertoire, which is also amazing. And that's what I want to, you know, raise our voice about, you know, the great things about our instrument. We can create so many different colors, effects. Mm. We can produce polyphony. We are one of the few instruments that is creating the sound directly by our hand.
Right. Yeah, it's not a mechanism.
Exactly. A mechanism or the bow. Or So there are so wonderful things on the guitar. And one more thing, the most important thing, is the most popular instrument in the world.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's a fact.
That's the bridge right there.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the bridge. That's my point. There's no rock band, folk band, bluegrass, mariachi, classical guitar, I mean, electric guitar. There are so many different ways or so many different manifestations of the instrument.
Yeah.
And that give us such a big potential to really spread out what the classical Spanish guitar can do, which is so much. I mean, if we start thinking that, electric guitar, you know, uses the pick.
Mm-hmm.
We have four picks in our right hand.
Yeah.
You know, we can...
The pick is a pretty silly thing.
Well, I mean, it's just one it's a different expressive tool, and that's fine.
Sure.
But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we can do so many things with the classical Spanish guitar. And that's something that relates to anybody that plays the guitar.
Yeah.
Anybody that plays the guitar hears.
And there are more of those.
Yes.
And that's the that's what tends to be the fan base, is people that have been exposed to it in some way.
And
understand the challenges that we're facing and appreciate the hard work.
And not only that, but, you know, if the guitar is the most popular instrument in the earth, it's because it has something unique in it.
Yeah.
That makes people connect to it, right? Because, you know, it could have been another one.
One of the things that's really, you know, that it gets a lot of shit for is being quiet. And that's also its saving grace. Because you can't play the violin at 3 a.m. But you can quietly, if you're quiet, you can play the guitar.
And, you know,
and that's something cool for, like, a high school kid.
And
you can sit there and be like,
and not only that, but music starts from silence. So we have a beautiful range, artistically speaking.
Yeah.
To go to such a beautiful and tender pianissimo.
Yeah.
That is so precious that a violin or a piano will never be able to deliver. And at the same time, and this is our responsibility as guitarists, we need to work on right hand sound, a sound that is full, a sound that is committed with a string, a sound that projects in a big hall. You know, I've played with the Pittsburgh Symphony for 2,600 seats hall without amplification playing the Aranjuez. And everybody was, you know, offering me a standing ovation.
What kind of guitar you play?
I play Matthias Damann.
Oh, that's what? You do play Damann. Yeah.
I play Damann. It's the same guitar that Barrueco, Russell, so many other guitarists play. It's a fantastic guitar. It projects a lot, but...
But it doesn't project that much. Yeah.
You need to have a full commitment. It's technique of the right hand. And that's, you know, it's like... If you visualize an archer.
Yeah, arrow, bone arrow archer.
Exactly. You know, if you don't have commitment with the string of the bow, you know, the arrow will, you know, fall in 2 meters. But if you extend that string to the limits and then you release it, that arrow is going to fly so far away.
So technically speaking, now that we're getting into that, how you're talking about you're talking about the right hand stroke, and so what do you think is slightly different about what you're doing when you're playing in Pittsburgh?
Well, this is the way I play the guitar. It doesn't matter if I play in Pittsburgh or
you're just
in
talking
a small
about
hall.
The full range of motion.
Exactly, full range of motion. The joint where the
movement starts,
like the first, joint.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Large
people
joint,
will.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a
waving
tennis
bye-bye
player.
Is what I always say to the kids.
Exactly.
You wave bye-bye. You don't,
exactly.
You don't crunch.
Exactly.
You wave bye-bye.
That's the big secret.
Right.
So it's like a tennis player. You know, if you see Rafael Nadal, he uses the whole arm. Starting, you know, in the,
it's a
in
90
the
degree
shoulder,
angle.
Exactly.
And then he comes all the way back.
He does, exactly.
Follow through.
Exactly. He doesn't play with the wrist.
I watch baseball, but why we ask?
Yeah, but it's the same thing.
Same thing. Yeah,
he doesn't play with the wrist. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way.
They're not
way.
Doing this. They're not
exactly.
Just fly swatting.
So with the guitar technique in the right hand, it's the same thing. Mm. It's, you know, using the large portion of your finger, big movements, and with a lot of commitment with the string. I think that's and then, you know, trying to explore the limits of the sound you can create in fortissimo to pianissimo. There is an infinite infinite
range
of dynamics in there.
Wow.
And that's our responsibility to explore, from going to the four piece to the three fortes. And, you know, and making the instrument sound with identity.
Right.
So, you know, that's also our responsibility. Because I feel sometimes we are so worried about the technique and being fast that we don't realize that the most basic element in music is sound.
Right.
So, you know, working on sound is always going to be your best investment.
When you studied in Germany, did you do any, I mean, who was your teacher in Germany?
In Germany was Thomas Müller-Tegin.
Okay, so I don't know anybody. I don't know that much, I don't feel like sometimes. But he, and then what city was that in?
It was in Weimar. It was close to Leipzig and 3 hours south of Berlin.
Okay, so this is more or less your undergrad education.
Well, actually, you know, I started playing the guitar when I was 6 years old.
Right.
So I studied in the conservatory in my hometown, and then I went to Santander for 3 years with Maestro Paulino García Blanco, and with him I worked for three years, right-hand sound production.
Right-hand sound production.
That's all we did in 3 years.
So this is the first step. First, real, with, for lack of a better word, guitar teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I had been studying for 7 years, so I was able to play the guitar, you know.
First college level guitar teacher.
Yeah, I could say so. And then I went to Madrid.
But when he's doing that, he's the one that's sitting there hammering in your brain the importance of stroke.
Exactly. Exactly.
The importance of,
he was very, very important.
When you did that, did you grow up playing classical, or did you?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay,
always.
So you always had that. Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't just rock and
no.
Then,
I always played classical guitar. And this teacher really defined a lot what I am as a musician today, because he also started to speak to me about phrasing. Articulation.
Okay. About, so this is a deep guy.
Exactly.
This is your big deep teacher.
Exactly.
Because not all teachers are that deep.
Yeah. I mean, all teachers have been wonderful.
100%. I totally agree. Every single teacher I've ever worked with is great.
But he gave me some tools that have been so important.
But there are
there
are those special teachers that are able to articulate abstract ideas in an attractive and poetic way.
And it was
those are the people that are in your head every time you're
exactly
practicing.
And I was young, and I was
very
16.
Yeah,
so
you've never met a guy like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was like the perfect timing to receive all those learnings.
Right.
And so it was, you know, it was the first person that was talking to me about music, not about guitar.
Yeah,
about music.
Art. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, in the end, that's what has been my motto, no? It's about what's going on. This is about music. So let's try to be musical.
Mm-hmm.
So so he was very important in that sense. But, you know, also David Starobin was very, very important. So every teacher was.
Yeah, because David Starobin is a heady guy.
He was so inspiring to me in so many different ways, he was.
I think he inspires everybody.
Yeah,
because he does so many. I heard that he used to stand with his guitar for a while there. I think that was when you moved here. Was when he was doing that. Was he doing the concerts where he stood?
Yeah, I think so. But I never saw him standing.
Yeah.
But what he gives you goes more than that.
Of course.
He's
like, watch this.
He's a musician also.
Right.
He's first, before a guitarist, he's a great musician.
Yeah.
So he would tell me all these great insights and comments on pieces that I know nobody would tell me. You know, his approach was very unique, and they were things that then, you know, I could apply to different pieces too. So it was like
pure
music.
You had mentioned that as a benefit of initially studying something like the Berio. Doing something like that, it does teach you how to phrase, because you have to phrase something that isn't obvious. And so you have to, as an artist, look for the connection between these things that are seemingly unconnected.
Exactly.
And find something beautiful to express in something that is seemingly not very pretty.
Yeah.
You know, and making it pretty again. And that's a skill that you can obviously use in a situation like when you're playing, you know, instead of Berio, you're playing Barrios now, and it's like, well, this is great. Now I have this tool that I can use,
exactly,
and it becomes that much easier to express yourself in pieces that are the kind of not play themselves. Nothing plays itself.
No.
But pieces that, you know, take a little bit of the load off your shoulders.
Are more part of our repertoire. Let's
put it that way. Part of what we've been. Part of our.
And it's tools. Yeah, David Starring gave me so many tools to understand and to really create an interpretation by my own in each piece. You know?
What about competitions and stuff? Sort of post. Or maybe graduate work, as far as that stuff. Did you do any of those things? I read about you once. I didn't read about you before the interview. I should have, but I actually just moved here, so I've been busy. But and I like this. This is by the way, you're the first guest in the new apartment.
Woo!
I was on 89th and 2nd forever, which was great. I was really nervous because first of all, I didn't know that you still lived here, and I was like. Are people going to want to come out here? Like people from other parts of the world, I think they're going to think like Brooklyn, is that, isn't it like crime and stuff? But you live here, so you know that this is sort of this is
so
a nice
beautiful.
Part.
It's
a good part.
Yeah.
But anyway, where do you live?
I live 92nd and Columbus.
Oh shit. I should have done you. Should have done it back in whenever the concert was, July, June. Okay, so that's my problem is that everybody lives up there. I work up there. I don't know why I did this.
No,
I made the good choice?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so what is
this? This is so beautiful and tranquil. In Manhattan, there is always noise. And here, you know, there is tranquility.
And
I got
a balcony.
There. Yeah. Who has a balcony in Manhattan?
Nobody.
Yeah. A few people on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, and you know what they use them for? Bike storage.
Exactly.
That's why my bikes are in here. I'm not going to be one of those assholes that just has a beautiful balcony and just uses it for bike storage.
That's great, Brett.
I'm not. Thank you. That's my contribution. You're doing a little bit more, but you know, as far as like, so you're 92nd Columbus. That's good. Hey, but that's beautiful.
Yeah, it is nice.
That's really good. I know exactly where that is. You've got that grocery store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Money Market.
Uh-huh. And is the Takira part across the street.
Yeah, exactly.
From
exactly.
Those are all my students around.
Wow.
You live next to Ben Verdery.
Yeah.
He lives right around the corner from you, I think.
Exactly.
That's a cool area.
Yeah, it's nice.
I like the Upper West Side. I would have moved to the Upper West Side. I needed to get out of the Upper East.
You're good here.
This is good, right?
Yeah, you're perfect here.
Yeah. This little pocket of neighborhood is really, I love. You know, the Knitting Factory is right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
No, it's fantastic. This Williamsburg is the best.
I think it is.
It is.
But I still miss Manhattan. I'm going to go there tonight and hang out with.
Yeah, somebody. Exactly. In 20 minutes, you're there.
I guess. Yeah. In 20 minutes, I'm in the good part of Manhattan.
Yeah.
But that's not where we work. We work in the boring part. As far as competitions and stuff like that, did you? What about all that?
I did a lot of competitions.
Sorry to change the subject
much. No. I
think you did, right? Did you? Are you a Torrega guy or whatever?
Yes.
Right, yeah.
And I won many competitions. I have like 30 prizes. But it feels like, you know, like a life and another life almost. So I started.
Because you don't play like a competition guy.
No. And even when
competition guys play the same way they played in the competition,
exactly.
The same rep. More or less for the rest of their lives.
But when I did competitions, I never played like a competition guy. I went on a stage playing. I mean, I don't
like
know.
Like you were giving a concert.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know any other way to play, but with full commitment and being yourself. You know, just being yourself, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I started with small competitions, and that helped me a lot to develop my concentration and to
just
the
small regional Midwest
exactly.
competition stuff like that
and in Spain.
Oh, in Spain.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I started in
Midwest
Spain.
Yeah. I don't know what that looks like. It might be critical. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
Mountainous.
Spain is so small that you know it's like
it's all one.
Yeah.
It's the size of Chicago.
So I started doing competitions when I was 18 around different ones in Spain, and that helped me a lot to develop the different techniques and to develop the tools to go on a stage and be concentrated and give the best of myself.
Yeah.
Because you know competitions. Is very anti-musical in the way that you go there and most of the time there are just five guys.
Right.
And you're playing for five guys.
Right.
I mean, if you get to the finals, then, you know, probably there will be some audience. But, and you only have 5 minutes or 10 minutes in the first round.
Which is
so,
not
you know,
a lot, yeah. That's
it's not a lot.
Never been my strong suit.
But you
those
need...
first 10 minutes.
Exactly. But, you know, there's no room for nothing else. and you chose to be there, and your responsibility for respect for the other guitarists is to give your best. So, you know, going there and trying to convince them through your personality and your musicality, your technique, everything.
Yeah.
And your emotional commitment too, because, you know, the jury is also human. So they feel things.
Yeah, they want. Yeah, they want. They're
exactly.
bored.
Exactly.
They sat through 10 exactly. dry performances. They're ready for something a
exactly.
little
so,
tantalizing.
So, you know, I learned many things from competitions.
Yeah.
It's not the only way to develop your career.
And you also learn that you can do a competition and you feel all those feelings. You're 18. You feel the feeling of not wanting to be there, wanting to run away. You go through with it. And then an hour later, you're still alive. Everything's fine.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So then you're teaching yourself that you can feel that way, that you feel before you get on stage, and that it doesn't necessarily affect, or you can lose a competition. You know what I mean? Stuff like
and
that.
In
it's
the
it's
end,
important to be able to lose.
Exactly. And in the end,
that's a big tool.
Who wins and who loses, no? It's, it's very important to get to competition or to address competition with a few very clear ideas mm-hmm. in your mind.
Yeah.
And your teacher has a big role in that, no? One is, you know, you are not better or worse guitarist. Either you win it or you don't win it.
Mm-hmm.
You're the same. You're the same guy.
Yeah, 100%.
And then, you know, there are many things that are out of your hands. So, you know, you need to let go. The most important thing in a competition, did you give yourself, did you give the best of yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Were you in a zone where you felt comfortable, even though you were, you know, nervous
freaking out, right.
or freaking out?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, were you able to enjoy some parts of it or being part of the music and deliver what you wanted to deliver?
Right.
If that's yes, you won the competition, even if they don't give you the prize. You know, on your own personal esteem, that's what counts. Of course, you know, you go to a competition because you want to win. But, you know, there are going to be 30 or 40 other guitarists that, you know, they all want to win. And that's good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you need to accept that, you know, it's a game. Sometimes you will have possibilities to win. Other times, no. And I have to admit that sometimes I didn't play my best and I got the first prize. And other times, I was playing my best and I got second or I didn't pass to the finals.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think competitions have good things. You can't rely on building a career on competitions.
Yeah.
There might be a handful that might help you with some things that might help you build your career, like, you know, if they give you a recording contract, like, you know, the Targa or a few others or the GFA,
right.
you record for Naxos. Well, that's the first step for exposure. Or the parking competition, which I also won. You know, that really pushed me. They put me a manager.
Management is what, because that's what they want. The management
exactly.
wants competitions.
Well, and not always.
Or you already have concerts.
exactly.
Yeah, that's really what it comes
to. You know, because if, I mean, finding a management is, it could be another question because that's, that
yeah,
requires
well, let's
a lot
let's
of,
talk about that. I mean, I'm actually dealing with that right now.
Yeah,
as
so.
As I go on with this quartet, it's very difficult.
Yeah. So.
Because they're writing back, they're like, well, we really like it, but we just don't, there's nothing there. There's no. Well, you're playing some libraries and stuff. That's nice, kid. But there's nothing we can really do.
Yeah. So when I won the parking competition, part of the prize was a concert tour in the USA.
I mean, let's face it. You're a very, from a management perspective, you're an attractive prospect. You play well. You dress great on stage. You're comfortable talking to the audience, and you won a shitload of competitions, and you're a great guitarist. So. I mean, it doesn't seem... Even in your situation, you said it was a whole...
Yeah.
It was a pain in the ass?
Yeah. It was... It hasn't been an easy path.
That's really
but, you
interesting
know,
to know.
But, you know, I don't want to...
Right.
I want to encourage people
sure.
to follow that path.
Sure, sure,
not
sure.
on the contrary.
to follow the path of
Building your career management. And pursuing your dreams, whether it's management or not, but pursuing your path.
Sure.
And finding a management is not easy. I say it clear, but
Let's talk about
it. Why not pursuing it, even if it's not easy?
No,
and that's been my experience.
But finding management seems to me to be a very difficult thing in the sense that, I don't know what the second step is, because you Google management, or you look at who's managing who, and there's a handful of people, and within a day or two, you've already contacted all of them. So what do you do in that situation?
Well, if I tell you my story, the first time I knock on the door of a management was when I was 18 in Spain.
Right.
And
what are they?
That first meeting went well. I showed him my biography and he said, thank you very much. You sound like a nice guy and a good musician. But I, right now in my roster, I have Pepe Romero and Jose Maria Gallardo del Rey. So, I don't have a place for you, but, keep me posted. So, I kept going to that office for 10 years.
When you went, you would go knock on the door.
Well, I would send him an email, I'm here, it'd be great to see you
again.
I'm
across the street.
Exactly. So he'd say, yeah, come here, and I'd see him again. That's my the management I have in Spain right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me 10 years.
2 years of knocking on the door constantly.
10 years.
10 years. So you're 28 years. When you get the management.
Exactly.
Okay.
The first time I got my first management, I was 28.
That happened because you, first of all, addressed one manager who gave you a little bit of the time of day. And you just, because I've had those too, where they're like, just try to do this with your website or whatever. But,
exactly.
And I'm like, okay, so, well, maybe I should keep calling. You should.
Yes, definitely.
And that's why they don't address you.
No
back.
One.
That's why they don't write you back, because they know that kid's going to come.
It's very difficult that managements are going to knock on your door.
Yeah.
Very difficult. So you need to go after them, and you need to find the right ones. And the bigger the managements are, the more difficult it's to be part of them.
Yeah.
So yes, my experience is, start with something, with an agency that is small.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important the personal connection you are going to have with that person.
Yeah.
Because in the end, he's a human being. He makes his business, selling concerts.
Right.
So he needs you. But at the same time, there are so many musicians in the world. Mm-hmm. So you need to, there has to be connection and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then, trying to be original and trying to take care of everything what they are expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, from your website, of course, all your pictures, videos, mm-hmm. all the materials that depend on you.
Mm-hmm.
Try to develop them in the best possible way.
Yeah,
but that's not only the only thing that you need. Of course, you need to be a great musician.
Yeah,
right. To connect. I don't know.
Well, most people need to understand that too. It's like a lot of the crybabies out there. There's a reason.
No, I don't want to discourage anyone.
No, we're not trying to discourage them, but if they just focused a little more on releasing albums regularly.
Exactly.
Or recording videos and stuff like that. If you just got that one album and you're whining because you don't have a manager, well, maybe you should, increase your output a little bit.
Yeah. You need to do many things by yourself.
Right. This you got to do a lot of stuff. That's the main
exactly.
point. The pictures, the videos.
And
right.
even if you have a management, you still have to do many things by yourself.
Yeah.
In the last 15 years, I've spent more time in front of the computer than playing the guitar.
Right.
So, we...
Yeah, you have,
We are entrepreneurs and our business is our music,
right?
So we need to make it work one way or the other.
Yeah.
So we need to try like the different paths, and there is not only one path to to pursue your dream. But 100%. So, and then, you know, if hiring a publicist is an investment, mm-hmm. then, you know, okay, let's try find ways to finance that.
Right.
From crowdfunding or to, you know, trying to find sponsorships. You know, I'm from Rioja in Spain, and it's famous for its wines. And there are so many wineries. So there is this winery that is focused mm-hmm. on art and culture. That's right. Their concept. And Vivanco is called. It's the finest wine in Rioja. And they have this great, amazing museum. And so I addressed them. And I said, listen, you know, I'm in this important moment of my career. I'm going to invest in my career.
Right.
And would you like to be part of the journey? Mm-hmm. I think we can collaborate together, and you know, you can benefit from my concerts, and you can benefit from my concerts, and I can benefit from your right. support. So we can support each other, and so now I'm the cultural ambassador of this winery, that allows me, you know, to finance the PR company.
Right. So you're talking. This is the thing. This is the behind the scenes thing that people don't really think. They think that you're just practicing. And that you're just like working on music, and that there's all these people kind of taking care of you, and that you just lucked out. You know what I mean? You just.
Yeah.
But no. You're a guy with an amazing amount of skill, and look at all the, like you said, you've spent more time on the computer, and I can attest to that. You know?
And I mean, to build a career
is a whole full time job.
It's a full time job.
We're doing two jobs.
Exactly.
Right.
We are doing two jobs.
Right.
Two jobs. And I've been doing two jobs. So, for example.
Even you are doing two jobs. That's what people need to understand.
And even now.
Right.
And I have management, and I have a PR agency.
But the managers still want you to do things for them. I mean, that's the thing. It's like they, you know, I think they were, this. I'm sort of stealing this from another podcast that happened. This is not a music one that I heard, the Mark Maron podcast. But he was talking with, you know, people in Hollywood about the management. Jason Bateman interview or something like that. And they were talking about this issue with the management and how the managers need you to help them.
Well,
too.
Like basically,
they aren't necessarily any less in the dark than you are. They're just calling people, and
exactly,
they're just like throwing things out. They're just spending the time doing it.
And but, in the end, I mean, it's
which is worth it.
It's important to understand the whole business.
That so no one's going to babysit you.
There are
ever.
Yeah, there are right. the presenters.
Right.
Okay, and the presenters,
right.
they know their audience, mm-hmm. and they want their mission is to hire musicians that will provide a good show to the audience.
Right.
The audience will go to the hall mm-hmm. if, you know, if they know of a musician.
Right.
If Lang Lang comes here to Carnegie Hall, it's going to be full house, sold out concert, I can assure you.
Right.
Why? Because everybody knows Lang Lang.
Right.
We're not talking about music, we are talking about everybody knows.
Name him. Recognition.
Exactly.
Right.
So then these presenters are in touch with managers, and managers are trying to sell them artist. So, you know, the presenter says, well, you know, you are telling me that you have a Lang Lang, and then you have Chinyu. And who is Chinyu? I don't know. He plays the marimba. He's amazing. He's great, great.
And they're like, well, that's great, but well, only 20 but people.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So the manager, when he's looking for artists, he's also looking for artists that are also in motion. So, you know, that they already have momentum.
Right.
Because for them, it's going to be easier to sell an artist that has momentum than an artist that nobody knows.
Right.
So how do you
get people to know you?
Get people to know you. Well, it's your responsibility,
yeah.
you know, from making, being creative, doing all your strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, trying to play concerts, invite people, trying to get reviews, do recordings.
Mm-hmm.
By your own. Yes, by your own.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, you know, you'll have to find sponsors to finance the recording. You have to find sponsors to... So, and it's your responsibility.
Right.
I mean, the manager won't do that because the mission of the manager is to sell you.
Something that's sellable.
Exactly.
Right, to a presenter. It's like that's the step. Step one, get people to listen to you.
Exactly.
That you don't know.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you can create.
And that's a huge challenge.
Exactly. So
right.
create a buzz around yourself.
Right.
create your audience, know your audience, meet your audience, take care of your audience.
Right.
And then
audience.
Exactly.
Audience, yeah.
We go back to
the beginning.
Know, the beginning.
We're
audience kind of, is the most important thing 100%. In this business. So, you know, if you play for them, if you
are thinking about them,
if you think about them,
entertainers,
right. if you are fully emotional committed with the music, so they feel that and they feel touched by your emotions when you play music,
they'll tell
then,
people to listen
you know,
to you.
It's yeah. like, I want to go back to whenever you are playing because, you know, you made me feel things that.
So the
nothing
management
else
and the publicists, they don't make you popular. You make you popular.
Well, no.
No? Okay, I'll take that back. We're going to erase that. The management and the publicists, blank. And then you say whatever you want and we'll edit that in.
No. I mean, it's your responsibility to take care of your audience and to build the momentum so management is going to be interested in you.
Yeah.
And then once your management is interested in you because you created your momentum, then management will try to sell you to presenters.
Right.
And then, you know, that that will help the audience to start growing.
100%.
Because when you start having opportunities, if those opportunities are a success,
right.
then the audience, you know, will be part of your groupies. Or
right.
Engage your audience. It will maximize your audience. And then the PR agency mission is like a speaker, like a loudspeaker.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to amplify all you are doing
yeah.
in different outlets.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you had a great success in Pittsburgh, then, you know, their mission is to let everybody know
how successful that was. Right.
You know, if you are presenting a CD, how it's the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, you know, this is the new CD of Pablo. You should listen to this because this, and that.
Right.
And please come to the venue. And so that's their mission. So in the end, still now, you need to work so many things. You need to create and to work on so many different aspects of your
yeah.
career independently that you have a management and a PR agency.
Right. There you go. And you brought it back around here in the end. Is there anything else that you want to talk about before we sign off? No.
I mean, a very important thing for me, it's out of
audience.
The blue now that I'm saying yes, but it's how I see music. And I think this can be nice for many of the listeners. For me, music is a big pyramid. The first and most important base is technique. Yeah. And you need to have that foundation.
Yeah.
Without that, you don't have anything. The second step is musicality. And you can teach a student to be musical.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mythology too. You know, you can think of pulses and phrasing and accents and articulations, and you can teach that.
You can. I agree.
Yeah, but then
some students don't end up doing it, but it is teachable.
Yeah, it's teachable.
Right.
And then, you know, the top of the pyramid,
right,
is the emotional commitment.
Right.
And that's what gives sense to the rest.
Right.
If you are playing an instrument, if you are doing music, and you have the great foundation of technique, marvelous. If you have a great musicality, marvelous. But you don't have an emotional commitment,
right.
You are missing the whole point.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, that tip of the pyramid for me
is really
the one that gives sense to musicality and technique.
Right. And what you're saying is, what's really interesting is that the most enjoyable aspect, probably the reason we decided to do this in the first place, was emotional commitment.
Exactly.
And then we go through all these different ways of how we're going to do this for a living, and we approach it from all these different angles, and we try to manipulate all these different facets of the industry, whether it be pursuing management, you know, but in the end, the only way to really get those things is, again, to have emotional commitment. And then second step, to share that with an audience.
Exactly.
So just everybody should remember to take time when you're phrasing, like Pablo does, and to be more emotional when you play and connect with your audience.
Well, I think that's true.
You're not saying it.
That's a big statement, and I totally agree with that.
There we go.
Because you know, everything starts with the audience and ends in the audience. Right, so you know, if you take care of your audience, it doesn't matter if it's a small audience.
Yeah.
In a church.
How are you going to bring them back? Well, you might have to learn more pieces.
Exactly.
You might not have to play the same exact concert twice. You might have to actually, you know, work on getting some new rep in there. If your rep's stale, do all sorts of different things you can do to keep people coming back. But keep them coming back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. How do you do that? You know.
I don't know. Oh, I know how you
do it. Open yourself
and work
give it yourself to them.
Yeah, 100%. Well, thanks so much for joining me again. You're going to be at Joe's Pub. Premiering your new album Americano with works from everybody, by everybody from Leonard Bernstein to you know, Roland Deans. All right, so that's going to be September what?
September 29th. At 7:30. And Americano is in the end this CD. It's an homage to this great continent, the Americas,
no? That's
North
right.
America and South America.
Right.
And there is a very interesting thing to say, that the Spanish guitar is one of the few instruments that is totally linked to a culture and a country, which is Spain.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, has become the most popular instrument, you know, and it was brought to the Americas through the colonialism in the 16th century. And then, you know, it was the instrument for many different cultural identities to express their own musical identities. So what I try to do with this CD is this journey from South America to North America, from Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Mexico, United States,
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, to define this journey through all the different rhythms and aesthetics.
Yeah, it's been a journey for you too. So you're not from here, so you're coming to the
exactly.
continent. And this is, you're reflecting.
Exactly.
You're reflecting now.
Exactly.
As we approach 40.
Exactly.
We're reflecting.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to the show.
Thank you so much, Bert. Hasta pronto.
All right, guys. That was my time with Pablo. I hope you enjoyed it. This is him playing Villalobos' Prelude No. 3. Remember that this is the pledge drive, right? And I don't expect, but I'm hoping, humbly hoping, that you'll go to brettwilliamsmusic.com and donate today. Hit the podcast link or the talk link, and you can donate on the right-hand side. All right, that's brettwilliamsmusic.com. Please. See you guys next time.